incarcerated or whether they're coming to visit someone. Yeah. It's just, why wouldn't I have some discussion and conversation about what's on their mind?
So before we get deeper into this, give us a sense of how did you come to this line of work? Who wakes up and says, you know what, I think I want to be a warden or...
Well, where'd you start? As a corrections officer?
Yeah, I started in 1988, which is kind of interesting because now when training classes come through, most of the class was born post-1988. So that's, you know, we're going on 30 years.
That's the gospel to us.
Next year, it'll be 30 years in this business. But it was really all a fluke how I got into this business. Mm-hmm. I was out of college. I was teaching, but I wasn't a certified teacher. I was like a permanent substitute teacher in the Waterbury school system. Come from a large family, had a lot of student loan, had a lot of student loan debt. And a friend of mine who worked as a correction officer said, "Look, they hire temporary correction officers for the summer, and." You just go down to this facility, you fill out the application, they'll train you, and then you can work for the summer, and that's a way to make some income. Well, I never left. I really liked the work. I went through, the academy, and from there moved my way up through the ranks. And I had some unique exposures throughout my career. Mm-hmm. I served as a legislative liaison, which is essentially the lobbyist for the agency. I served as a spokesperson, but those unique experiences I think prepared me to have more of a global understanding of government and to understand the many aspects of incarceration and justice and everything that comes along with that.
Where'd you grow up?
I was born in Cheshire, but I primarily grew up in Waterbury. Mm-hmm. I went to public school there, so and I'm grateful for it. I was grateful for that experience to go to public school in City Waterbury.
You're a good kid? Get into trouble? I mean, what was your...
I would have been arrested if I was in high school today because, there's a... you're a lot more vulnerable when you don't do the right thing today than you were back then. Yeah. Back then, if you had a police interaction, it's more common that they would put you in the car and bring you to go see your parents. And that's probably was not a good thing. But... that being said, I was a good kid. I never got suspended. I was never, one of those. I guess I wouldn't be. That's for others to determine. But I don't think I was a bad kid.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when you were a warden, talk about that experience. Like, when did you become a warden, and how did it? What did you think when you took that on?
So I became a warden on July 1st, 2009. And I thought that was really, I reached the pinnacle of my career. That's all, that's really was my career goal, was to one day become a warden. And obviously a lot of responsibility. I was at the time the warden at the Garner Correctional Institution. It was a $26 million operating budget. You had hundreds of staff, hundreds of incarcerated people that you were responsible for. And then there was a mission to deal with the specialized nature of the facility to develop an appropriate response to the mental health needs of the vast majority of the folks there. And just want to emphasize, it's not everyone there is for that purpose, but the vast majority were. So I served as a deputy warden and prior at that facility. And so I had a good understanding of what the mission and goals were for that facility. And it was just really to build on that and to move the facility forward in meeting the treatment needs of, the treatment needs of the population there.
Did it surprise you the amount of politics, bureaucracy, paperwork? I mean, all of a sudden you're like not on the front line anymore. You're in a job which probably requires a completely different skill set.
The transition did not seem very difficult for me. The transition that was most difficult for me was when I was promoted from warden to deputy commissioner.
Oh.
And I can give you some background on that.
Sure,
as well.
Please.
But when I became deputy commissioner, the announcement was made before my peers, the wardens, and it was kind of a moment where I felt like I was on my own island, because there's only one, you know, one deputy commissioner of operations, and the commissioner announced me as the new deputy commissioner of operations. There's actually two deputy commissioners in the agency, one for administration and one for operations. But I was like, wow, I'm really on my own now. And I really felt a sense of obligation and responsibility to deliver. And not only to deliver to the expectations of the commissioner, but to all of the people that were in the room and all of the folks that were in the system and all of the staff. So I went from managing about 300 staff to managing almost 6,000 staff and, you know, 15 facilities and a $680 million budget. Versus a $26 million budget. So that was a moment in time that it really began to make me reflect there, are you prepared to do this? And there was a lot of personal issues in my life at the time, shortly after becoming deputy commissioner, that really made me question whether I would stay in this business. Shortly after I became the deputy commissioner, our son was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer. Yeah. And he, that happened a little over 3 years ago. And he passed away about 3 months later on January 1st, as I said, a little over 3 years ago. I was prepared to leave the field. I did not think I could do this anymore. And it was a very interesting and, quite frankly, traumatic time for me. And at the same time, the existing commissioner decided to take a position in New York City with the New York City Department of Correction as the first deputy commissioner. And they quickly asked if I would be the interim or acting commissioner. And I wasn't going to accept it, but I decided to accept it because I consulted my son and my wife. And my son was the person who convinced me to do it. Quite frankly, he said that I forgot how he put it, but he said, you always wanted to be the boss, and now you have an opportunity to be the boss. But you're never the boss, right? Yeah. Everybody has a boss.
In fact, we've had conversations with your wife about how she's gets angry with you about taking out the garbage. So maybe she's really the boss.
Mom's well, always the boss.
Fast forward. That conversation inspired me to take on the role. And about 2 weeks after Matthew passed away, Governor Malloy and I had a discussion, and he nominated me, and I went through the legislature. And, you know, I have to really, sometimes our governor gets a bad rap, but I can tell you that, I can affirmatively tell you that I would not have done this if he was not the governor. And the way that he, worked with me and was very open to allowing me time to make the decision. Quite frankly, I to this day, there's no way I would have accepted this position if he wasn't the governor.
Mm-hmm. You know, the way that I met Scott originally was that, you don't mind if I tell you this little piece of the story, that Scott's son Matt and my stepdaughter Skylar were on the crew team together at school. And when Matt got sick, the school, it was the gunnery, the school rallied around him. And so they had Matt Semple wristbands and Matt Semple t-shirts. And it was a big deal that one of their own had gotten sick. And after Matt passed away, I think it might have been the day after his funeral, actually, Scott went up and addressed the students. I'm feeling it right now. And he addressed the students and talked about how precious life is and how you have to take cherish every day. And you touched an entire student body and the faculty and everyone who was there that day. It was incredible. And with your courage to do it, the day after, I just want to tell you that it certainly made a fan out of me that you were willing and able to do that.
Well, thanks. I forgot about that. But it's interesting that the Gunnery School, it's in Washington, Connecticut. It's a wonderful, wonderful school. And I remember, not to get off topic here, but the reason Matt went there was for two reasons. One was he was a bright, very smart boy. And the other one was I wanted him to go to that school because it was had a very diverse student body.
It does.
Unlike the town that we live in, which is in Litchfield County. And I had that exposure as a kid going to school in an inner city. And I thought that there was a big advantage to being in a diverse environment. And so that was really one of the reasons why we bucked up the money for him to go there. It's not cheap.
Mm-hmm. So, Scott, talk a little bit about, we're going to shift gears a little bit. And thank you for sharing about your son.
Yeah, thank you.
Because I'm a parent and I can't even imagine that level of grief. That probably stays with you, will stay with you for the rest of your life.
Oh, can I just ask a follow-up question about that? I apologize, Babs. How difficult was it for you and your wife to name an award in Matt's honor and then knowing, I mean, it must have been a blessing, but also difficult for the Matt Semple Award to come about. And can you tell us about that a little bit?
You're talking about the scholarship?
The scholarship, yeah.
That was not my idea. That was brought to us by folks in the nonprofit community, namely Scott Wilderman and others.
Dan Braccio.
Yeah, Dan, and I can't name everyone that was involved in the thing, but they named a scholarship in Matt's name for a formerly incarcerated person who wants to pursue college opportunities. It was not a difficult thing. The whole exposure to the death of our son, and Matt Chris and I, our only child, it really changed my philosophy on the things that you traditionally get worked up about. Did not seem to bother me as much, because quite frankly, the worst thing in my life has already happened.
Mm-hmm.
So why not be bold? Mm. And it really kind of led and energized the direction that I felt compelled to bring this department to.
And that's a good segue.
Yeah.
Because I want to talk to you about, there is a Hollywood persona about prison and wardens and corrections. And then there's the reality of correction. So talk a little bit about your personal philosophy and how you work against the stereotype of what correction is. Because I think people have this mindset of what punishment ought to be and what they wish it would be, and then what it really is. So can you talk a little bit about how you combat some of the stereotypes around correction and your own personal philosophy that runs up against what people think a correction commissioner should be and what a warden should be? I mean, we've seen the films. We've seen Shawshank Redemption, and we've seen
Oz,
Prison
Break,
The Wire. I mean, we've been inundated with all these kinds of images of correction and those kinds of things.
Right. So it's said that if you're a correctional professional, a correctional officer, a counselor, if you work in corrections, you're right. Everyone has a television perception of what corrections is, right? And it's not good, right? So you always have something to say at the party, right? Tell me about it. Is it like you said, Babs? Is it like Shawshank?
Yeah.
Right? And the fact
a little bit.
The fact of the matter is, it's not even close, right? And even the stuff that they call reality TV, quite frankly, some of that stuff can happen, but it's not a true presentation of what goes on in correctional facilities. So in large part, less than 10% of the population creates 90% of the problems. Mm. The vast majority of incarcerated folks, they want to fulfill the obligation of their sentence and move on with their life, right? So we're not the Department of Incapacitation.
Wow. Right?
We're the Department of Correction. And our job is to help correct people. And what I've tried to do is influence a different approach, is that as much as we're very good at dealing with problematic issues, and we've been very good at dealing with problematic issues, our facilities are clean and for the most part quiet. But how do we move beyond clean and quiet? And it's as simple as being responsive to people who want to be accountable to themselves. So the message is, if you want to be accountable to yourself, we'll prepare ourselves to be accountable to you. So we launched some initiatives in order to do that, to send a message that this is the direction that we're going. And if you're committed, you'll be able to avail yourself to these opportunities. So we became and have become much more incentive-based. Correction officers and correctional professionals, you know, they get a bad rap. Along the lines of what you said is, you know, the television perception, as I like to call it. But the fact of the matter is, their job is extremely, extremely important in terms of fulfilling the mission of improving public safety. Because if they fail, the likelihood of failure from a public safety perspective is much more prominent. Right, so they're on the back end of the system, and quite often they don't get the same accolades as someone who is, for instance, a police officer or a judge or a probation officer or a parole officer. And parole officers work with me, and they're fantastic, and they don't get all the credit they deserve as well. But the fact of the matter is. They should be on par, on balance with anyone who is working in the criminal justice system.
Sure.
Because if they fail, if a correctional professional does not fulfill the obligation of correcting, then we're not better for it.
Mm. So Scott, I mean, you're known probably internationally at this point as a progressive reformer. Well, you've been to... you know, you went with Vera and a group of people over to Europe and all of that, and you're certainly known all over the country. And we know you're a ranking member of several of these national organizations. But you're known as a progressive reformer, someone who's right on the cutting edge. How did that happen? And then what's your frustration of trying to be that progressive reformer in a state that has such debilitating and overwhelming budget problems, and what does that prevent you from doing? And if you could wave a magic wand and have unlimited amounts of money, which is impossible, of course, what would you be doing differently, or what more could you do? That's a multi-part question.
Unlimited amounts of money.
Yeah.
I'd give myself a raise. No, I, obviously, my staff deserve a raise. I don't think anyone would argue. Well, some may argue with that, but in my world, no one would argue with that, knowing the complexity of their work. But I would advance the programs on a larger scale that we've introduced within the last a little over 3 years now. And I think that I would entertain other partnerships that we've had. Like, one of the things that has most impacted our work is the partnerships that we have with the nonprofit community. They have been impacted like we have been impacted. So there's this flow of, you know, this is the budget and this is the money that we have to work with. It's just like at home when you're balancing your checkbook. There's certain things that you cannot.
There's a balanced checkbook? Oh, my God.
You know, it's funny because my wife is, I can't balance my checkbook, but I operate a $620 million budget as of, I don't know, more recently. And I'm a numbers freak, and my staff will tell you I'm a statistics freak. And my wife is like, well, why don't you do this at home? You know, and I have no answer for
that. Because I have no staff at home.
Right. But anyway, long story short is we're working within the framework of what we have available to us and trying to make the best of those circumstances. So there are some really great things that we have launched, and we have launched them early on in my commissionership, and now we have data to prove that they work. But you know, if I had my druthers, I would advance those. But what's equally as important is to embed them into the fabric of what we do. And in order to do that, you have to be very transparent about what the data looks like and the metrics look like, so the staff understand that they're having an impact. And you have to be willing to adjust if it's not working. And that's how you build trust with the people that you're asking to do this work. And quite frankly, none of this stuff gets done unless the staff on the front line believe in what you're doing.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Criminal Justice Insider with Babs Rawls-Ivey and Jeff Grant. And today our guest is Scott Semple, the Connecticut Commissioner of Correction. You're listening on 103.5 FM, WNHH, and it's live streaming on New Haven Independent. And this program is brought to you by Family Reentry, serving the justice community since 1984, and the Community Foundation of Greater New Haven, now more than ever. So let's continue this conversation. Scott, talk to us a little bit about, well, there's a couple of questions I want to ask before we get away. The politics of things, because we are in a budget situation, and everybody's got to take a hit, and everybody's taking a hit. But how do you maneuver these political waters? How do you move the agenda of what you need to do up against political correctness or political ignorance, or because people feel some kind of way about correction,
mm-hmm.
or the harsh reality of where we are in a budget,
yeah,
and everybody competing for dollars, and corrections is on less or more of a priority for different people.
That's a really great question.
Good one.
He's
Babs.
Like, I didn't come on here to ask. I didn't come on here for these hard questions.
It must be the red headphones, Bab.
Let me say that you're right about. There is a certain level of competition within agencies that everyone, you know, traditionally wants to get their piece of the pie. Our governor's like, you know, stop. We don't want the silo approach. He wants agencies working together. And we have done that. We have done that a lot. We work a lot with agencies that traditionally don't work together. The Department of Veterans Affairs in Connecticut has helped us with advised us on some things that we've done for veterans that are happen to be incarcerated. The Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, it's always worked really closely with us, and Department of Social Services really stepped up in trying to help us get folks the benefits that they need prior to being released. The Court Support Services Division of the Judicial Branch, we really borrowed from them their ability to create a certain level of credibility before the legislature. And they did that through transparency and data analysis. They were able to prove that the programs had a cost benefit in terms of delivering programs to the population that they serve and the appropriate dosage of programs that they provide to that population. So, you know, as indicated before, I was the legislative liaison at one point in time, and there was a certain degree of envy when the judicial branch was before the Judiciary Committee, which is the same committee that traditionally corrections goes before. And one thing that I had always noticed was that they were very credible, and I tried to mimic that for the agency. So we become very data-driven, and when I present before the legislature or meet with elected officials, more often than not, I try to bring to them the framework of what we're trying to do with the benefits that go along with the data and metrics that we provide. And I think that over time has helped us influence and therefore deliver back to the agency.
Mm. You know, one of the things that I want to make sure that we hit before we run out of time, because we have about 12 more minutes or so in there somewhere.
About 15.
15 minutes. I want to make sure we talk about the TRU program.
Yeah.
And there and how you decided to use mentors there in kind of a radical way, probably for inside a prison, maybe mm-hmm. not so radical in the community, because there's a lot of mentoring that goes on out in the certainly on the streets and in nonprofits, mm-hmm. and we probably don't give enough credit to what's going on in the communities themselves in terms of people taking care of each other and
right.
people who've been through the system who mentor one another on an informal basis.
Mm-hmm.
But you've actually done it in a formal basis. And how did that come about?
So just so everyone's aware that the TRU program is a program that we put into place for the 18 to 25-year-old population. I refer to it as emerging adults. And as far as the determination of mentorship, I didn't make that determination. The staff made that determination for me, right? So I put out a concept based on my exposure to a facility in Germany that was designed specifically to meet the needs of this population. So it kind of evolved around the whole notion of neuroscience and the frontal lobes, and I'm not the person to kind of walk you through that, but but we do know that this is a very impulsive age group, right? And for those of us, you know, I'm 26, so I just got over it, and so I know what these folks have been through.
Yeah.
And anyway, when I came back from Germany, I was very intrigued by that program, and the governor was with me, and I said, "This is what we can bring back," and we both agreed, and he said, "Do it." And the original intent was to repurpose an entire facility, because what had happened when we got back to Connecticut is we started to look at the population breakout, and it was a little over 3,000 folks that were in that age group, and then we started to evaluate their disciplinary interactions or incidents, for lack of a better word. And they were responsible for almost 25% of the incidents that were occurring inside of our correctional facilities.
Wow.
And again, this all evolves around the whole issue of impulsivity and things of that nature. So that trip that I went to Germany on was sponsored by an organization called VERA. I love VERA. They're an outstanding organization. They're essentially a criminal justice think tank, and
Nicholas Turner and all the
Nick Turner, he's a Yale guy, mm-hmm. and you know, I called him. I said, "Look, I think we want to do this, and would you help us?" And they stepped up, mm-hmm. and they came to Connecticut, and we began the process of implementing this program, and we scaled it down because of the budget circumstances mm-hmm. that we were facing. And thank God we did that, because this is very, very difficult work. Mm-hmm. And we dedicated to one unit within a correctional facility at the Cheshire Correctional Institution. We chose that facility because it's in the center of the state. And I had two things that I wanted to happen. One is I wanted the staff to get the appropriate amount of training that was necessary, because we knew we were going to have to take a different approach. Mm-hmm. And the second one was that I wanted the families of these incarcerated folks to be involved. And those were my only two rules. But when I came back from Germany, I started to do all the research about brain development. And there really wasn't a lot of stuff that was specific to a correctional environment. And we found that there were systems in the country that were separating this population from the older population, but they didn't really have anything comprehensive from a programming perspective. And that was necessary. And this is through interactions and consult with Vera, that this is where we had to go. So we invested a small amount of money to train about 100 staff that were going to work in this unit. Mm-hmm. And we launched this unit. It's really in its infancy, and I don't have any data to prove it works, except in my professional opinion and the little data that we have. And I mentioned before that this population was responsible for 25% of the incidents that were occurring in facilities. We've had little to no incidents in this unit.
Wow. And that's phenomenal.
And I think it's for two reasons. One of the things that was out of the box was to introduce this mentorship program, right? And these are folks who have been incarcerated mostly since they've been juveniles, are now adults. And it was really the warden in consult with a committee that we had put together and the staff that were have volunteered to be involved in the program that kind of went down the road of let's bring mentors into the unit. And the mentors live on the unit. And we did specialized training for them in mentorship. So that, coupled with the family integration piece, I think has really been the brainchild for what has led to our ability to lower these incident rates within this unit. So in essence, you've created less trauma exposure and improved the health and wellness of the staff and the population.
Now, are these mentors, are they lifers?
Can I jump in here for a second? We have somebody on the call. Do we want to take this call?
Sure.
All right. Hello, caller. May I ask who's speaking?
Yes. Hi, this is Rabbi Hecht calling in from New Haven. How are you?
Hi, Rabbi. Are you? Do you have a question for us?
I do have a question for Scott. Am I live on the radio?
You are very live on the radio.
Oh, well, it's great to be live in New Haven. Scott, I just want to thank you for everything you're doing. I'm a rabbi at Yale, and I've been up to some of your facilities to visit prisoners. There's an effort right now in Connecticut to allow Jewish prisoners to light their Hanukkah menorahs. And it's been very challenging to get the Department of Corrections to help us with this effort. And I was hoping that you could use all your energy and wit and smarts to make this happen this year. Hanukkah's a few weeks away.
Yeah, I recently had received some correspondence about this, and we had received it in years past. And I'm not at liberty to discuss exactly what we're going to do, but I think we are going to be able to take a step in a positive direction with Hanukkah coming up this, about 2.5 weeks from now?
Or? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So happy Hanukkah, by the way, Rabbi.
And I want you to know that I own a company in New Haven, and we've been very active in allowing former prisoners back into the workforce.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your work.
We're very, and across all racial and ethnic and religious backgrounds.
Yes.
It's fantastic what you're doing. And like you spoke about before, correction is where it's at. We believe that out here. If you can do this Hanukkah effort like all the other states in the union are allowing them to light Hanukkah menorahs, I think it will bring a lot of light to the world, not only for the Jewish prisoners, but for the non-Jewish ones as well.
Well, thank you, caller, for your question and your sentiments. And thank you for listening to us.
I appreciate it.
Okay. So that's interesting.
So we're reaching the faith community out there too. So that's a good thing to know.
That's quite interesting.
And how, yeah.
So go ahead.
So what's the big plan now? I mean, now that you've got the true units off the ground and you've you've established yourself and, you know, as a person that people trust. I mean, what's your big plan? I mean, over the next year or year or two, what can we expect?
We want to, I talked about enhancing things at work. We believe that we want to enhance the TRUE program to the York Correctional Facility for mm-hmm. Women. We want to enhance the TRUE program and another housing unit at the Cheshire Correctional Institution. We also want to put a focus on the female population because although we've been very fortunate to achieve record low with our overall population, we're under the 14,000 mark. At one point in time, we were almost at 20,000. Mm. Wow. But that is primarily benefited the male population. Mm. The female population has been essentially in Connecticut a flat line for the last 10 years, and nationally that population is on the increase. Mm-hmm. So we want to try to enact some of the initiatives that we did, but we're going to have to do it in a different way because there's different needs for the female population. Mm. And we've required to rely on external folks to help us navigate through that to come up with a plan. But we want to reduce the female population commensurate with the male population. So I put a goal in front of our committee that's working on that to reduce that population by 25%.
Mm. Mm.
And so far, even just the announcement and that population within the last year has been reduced by 10%. Mm. And that's a good thing because, as I indicated earlier, nationally, it's on the upswing.
Yeah.
Now, do you think we're as progressive as we can be in Connecticut? Are there other states doing more or different or better? Are we on par with some of the best, or are we just kind of getting there?
We are the model in the United States right now.
Mm.
And for a number of reasons. It's not just correctional practices and changes that we made, but crime is down in Connecticut. There's a lot of different things that are going on right now. And, you know, and I have to really put the emphasis on the governor of our state, who has really taken an aggressive approach to criminal justice reform. And I think he's made all the right moves, and we're beginning to see the benefits of that. Mm-hmm. Connecticut is one of the few states in the country, and you can count them on one hand, that has lowered its incarceration rate and crime rate in its state.
Mm-hmm.
And we're beginning to see a reduction in recidivism. So there's a lot of good things that are happening in Connecticut. I'm humble about this because, you know, it's fragile and things can change. But we know that the governor's not running in the next election. And I think it's very important that whoever the next governor is, that they take a really good look at some of the practices that have been in place, not only through my administration, but my predecessors as well, and to realize the benefit in improving folks' overall wellness.
Is anybody looking at you?
For what?
For governor? Is anybody whispering your name?
Maybe for president.
For governor.
Is anybody whispering?
No.
I'll start that rumor.
No.
You heard it here first.
But Scott, it must take the collaboration of a lot of stakeholders in this ecosystem for this to happen.
Absolutely.
Sentencing judges and prosecutors and police. Yeah. And yeah.
Well, I mean, I know there's probably a lot of folks from New Haven listening, mm-hmm. and there's a guy from New Haven who has really been a big part of all this. Mm-hmm. His name is Michael Lawler. He's the Undersecretary for mm-hmm. Criminal Justice and mm-hmm. the governor's advisor. Mm-hmm. He serves as an advisor to me. Mm-hmm. And he is probably, when I travel around the country to talk with different folks about the work that goes on in Connecticut, and when you mention Michael's name, he's known. And so there's a lot of good things that are in place in Connecticut with some really good people, and there's some really good stuff going on.
You know, Babs, one thing I want to tell you about the commissioner as well, I don't want to make you blush, but he's very, very accessible. We had an idea to bring portals into a Connecticut prison. And you know, portals are this immersive space where you can communicate with people in another portal as if you're in the same room. And we had a partner, Shared Studios. So we've become the lead criminal justice partner for them. And we thought it would be great to hook up a portal in downtown Bridgeport and a portal in a prison. So I called up the commissioner and I said, we need you to see this because it's new and it's cutting edge. And we'd like Connecticut to be the first prison system to have a portal installed. And I would say within a week, you and John Santa came down to the portal, which at the time was a portal that was in Greenwich. And I think you had an amazing experience, and you saw right away that this is something that the kind of thing I think that you want to promote to take a leadership position in the country.
It would be unique. It would be the first of its kind inside of a correctional facility. There's a lot of logistical aspects to this that my staff want to kill me about.
And my staff.
Yeah. And however, I'm very interested in the concept because one of the things that happens, you know, that we take for granted is, you know, the correctional system deals with the people that come into the system. But one thing that we do know is that it has a detrimental effect on the families.
Mm-hmm. We talked about that with Robin Porter, and yeah, she talked about, you know, when someone goes to prison, it's not just that person, the whole family, and oftentimes the whole community serves that time too.
Robin probably would say it better than I do because she's experienced it. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I do want to say that one of the things that I have done that I'm so grateful for is that I've met with a lot of previously incarcerated folks to help steer me in the direction that I think we have gone and may go based on their experiences in the agency. And at one point in time, I what you really think is working is not necessarily the case based on what the consumer says.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did find out was, I have to be careful how I say this, but they're like, well, we like the programs, but the programs is not what influenced me to change. It was their peers and the staff and these interactions and communication.
Yeah.
So we're trying to put more of an emphasis on our staff to be better communicators because really educate them that they're having an influence on the population. But if you really think about it for a minute and you think about, you know, the day-to-day role of a correctional professional, they never get to see what success looks like. They only see what comes into the system.
Yeah.
So we need our staff to see success. They need to know that they're having an impact.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And on that note, we're going to bounce out of here.
Yeah, well, we're gonna ask the commission to pose for a few pictures before we leave the
studio.
Oh,
yeah, but we got to get off the air.
Oh, yeah, get off the air. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Happy Thanksgiving.
The next host. I hear she's a piece of work. Would be me. So thank you so much, Scott Simple, Connecticut Commissioner of Correction. And thank you to Family Reentry for sponsoring today's show, serving the justice community since 1984, and the Community Foundation of Greater New Haven, now more than ever. So we will have a happy Thanksgiving. Jeff and I will be back December 1st with the Catal Center co-executive director, Lorenzo Jones.
Lorenzo's a good man.
So we're going to have him on next. And thank you, Commissioner. And we hope you come back.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's so much more that we want to talk to you about corrections in Connecticut. Correction in Connecticut.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Babs. Love you.
Love you, too. Thank you, Andrew, for listening. And Harry, hit something.
All right. Thank you, Harry.
Crime. Folks think they ain't deserving of legal representation. And when I say that I can't help, my client pulls out a gun. He puts the barrel to my head and pulls the hammer back. That's when my lips begin to move as I tell him I don't know Jack. 'Cause I didn't go to Harvard, I didn't go to Yale, I didn't go to Stanford, 'cause I spent my life in jail. That's right, prison. That's where I got my JD. I'm a jailhouse lawyer, dumb as a lawyer can be. One day this guy in D block was having quite a tiff. It seemed his mashed potatoes were just a tad too stiff. He asked if I could help him, so I drafted a complaint. I cited the Eighth Amendment, it's the prisoner's patron saint. And I wrote in big bold letters so no judge would have to squint. Eating stiff mashed potatoes is cruel and unusual punishment. No, I didn't go to Harvard, I didn't go to Yale, I didn't go to Stanford, 'cause I spent my life in jail. That's right, prison, that's where I got my JD. I'm a jailhouse lawyer, dumb as a lawyer could be. Folks ask why I'm in prison, I tell them to take a seat, 'cause my tale isn't pretty and the ending's not sweet. One night I was driving with this babe wearing pink. I rolled through a stop sign, the cops threw me in the clink. I asked my lawyer what to do, he said to cop a plea. So I did, and the judge sentenced me to prison for an eternity. No, I didn't go to Harvard, I didn't go to Yale, I didn't go to Stanford, 'cause I spent my life in jail. That's right, prison, that's where I got my JD. I'm a jailhouse lawyer, dumb as a lawyer can be.